McCrispy strips are now at McDonald's. Tender, juicy, and its own sauce. Would you look at that? Well, you can't see it, but trust me, it looks delicious. New McCrispy strips, now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Now at Menards, save big on everything for your landscaping project. Whether you're shopping for edgers, pavers, or wall blocks, Menards has the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block ready to take home today. Plus, get fast free estimates when you use our landscape design program available in-store and on Menards.com. Save big on landscape blocks when you shop at Menards. Also, check out the great deals from our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
How do we make economics of interest to the general public? Well, my next guest has written a new book entitled Edible Economics, A Hungry Economist Explains the World, bringing the one commonality we all share, food, right into the economics classroom. I'm joined on the line by Ha Jun Chang, author and professor of economics at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. Thank you for having me.
It's a fascinating book, I have to say. I was greatly entertained by it, and we can't cover everything in its scope. But let's just talk about some foods. For example, I'm fascinated about the anchovy and how that impacted Peru. It's an extraordinary story.
Yes, indeed, the mid-19th century, Peru had an economic boom, which was called the guano boom. And this was that bird guano from the seabirds feeding on anchovies on the Pacific coast of Peru. And that guano was a very highly prized fertilizer at the time. And they exported it to Europe and America. And there was a massive economic boom, except that 30 years later, they overexploited the guano stock, and they were running out of the money. And then they found saltpeter, which could also be made into the fertilizer, but also into gunpowder. So they staggered on. But in the early 20th century, German chemist called Haber invented a way of fixing nitrogen from the air, and invented artificial fertilizer, and that was the end of economic phase.
So you had anchovies, the birds are eating the anchovies, they poo, and these mountains of bird poo become fertilizer, and that was wonderful until Fritz Haber came along and managed to take nitrogen from the air. So goodbye, Peru's fertilizer exports.
Exactly, and there are so many stories like that. You know, Guatemala in Central America used to be quite rich in the 19th century because it had a near monopoly on the natural red dye called cochineal, which was produced by this insect that basically grew in the tiny part of southern Mexico and Guatemala. But once again, the Germans and the British invented artificial dye that destroyed the Guatemalan economy.
Yeah, so those are commodities that the developing world was exporting. Technology in the developed world did for them and affected their exports. There's another chapter, which is, you know, we all love to eat shrimp and prawns. Yes. But yet we won't eat insects. And there's precious little, when you look at them, difference between the two.
Absolutely. That's the biggest mystery to me, you know, that the people who gladly eat, you know, the prawns, shrimps, the lobsters, langoustine, why wouldn't they eat insects? You know, we used to eat a lot of deep fried grasshoppers in Korea when I was a kid. We also ate the silkworm pupa, so that's the thing inside the cocoon of silkworm after you take the silk out, and that became a very tasty snack.
Now, you go on to the silkworm and, you know, Japan and how it developed its industries. And this actually leads inexorably, the kind of government that Japan employed, it leads inexorably, really, to the success of companies like Toyota, Mitsubishi, Sony, and all the rest of them.
Exactly, yeah. So, of course, silkworm farming was originally started in China a couple of millennia ago, but you know, in the 20th century, the biggest silk manufacturing country was Japan. You know, until the 1950s, silk was by far the biggest export item of Japan. So when the companies like Toyota tried to produce cars and export them, everyone thought that they were crazy. And of course, by the standard of market conditions of those days, it was a crazy the decision, but you know that the Japanese the government protected the car industry. They subsidized these companies until they grew up and became the most successful automobile manufacturer in the world. Mm-hmm. And the same story goes for you know the Korean car company Hyundai when it started producing. It's a model in 1976. It produced 10,000 cars. In the same year, Ford produced 1.9 million. General Motors produced 4.8 million. So if I took a time machine, went back to 1976 and told people that there's this unknown car company in a very poor country called Korea, but give it just over 30 years, it'll be bigger than Ford. And under 40 years, it'll be bigger than General Motors. People that put me in a mental hospital, you know.
Yeah, but that's so what happened. But the thing is, you link everything back to food. And in this case, it's the noodle or pasta. And Giorgetto Giugiaro, the famous Italian designer who designed the first really big popular motor for Hyundai, which was the XL. And then, you know, that was perfected and exported. They wouldn't let foreign cars into Korea for a period so that locals would buy the car and help in its development. But here's the question, which I don't think is addressed in your book. If this kind of protectionism works so well, why wasn't Lada successful? Why wasn't Trabant successful?
Oh, yeah. The difference was that those guys basically accepted second-rate technology and kept producing them. Whereas Koreans and the Japanese, they knew that they eventually had to compete in the global market. You know, they knew that the protection wouldn't last forever. Whereas in the Soviet bloc countries, they basically formed their own economic sphere. And then their cars might have been okay in the 1940s, 50s, but later turned into joke. So there are two different types of protectionism. One is that what the Soviet bloc countries and some developing countries in the past used to pursue, basically the trying to protect what they have without any ambition to join the world market eventually. Whereas what Korea, Japan, and indeed Britain, the United States, Germany, and so on before them, but did was temporarily to protect their young industries until they grew up and succeed in the world market. Yeah. This idea, therefore, is known as infant industry protection. And the inventor of this theory is none other than the very first finance minister of the United States of America called Alexander Hamilton, the first Treasury Secretary of the country.
Now, you talk about okra and foods that came in from Africa with the slaves. It leads us on to the revolution in Haiti, where the slaves took over government, frightened the French. The French, therefore, sold off Louisiana to the Americans, and America ultimately becomes a superpower.
That's right. Yeah, no, the enslaved Africans that brought them with themselves things like okra, you know, the banana, watermelon, and so many things into the Americas. Now, when we talk about the slavery, we think it's a minor barbaric practice that happened in a limited area of the United States. But the country would, first of all, not have even initially developed, but because something like up to 65% of American export in the 19th century came from cotton and tobacco, the famous slave crops. Mm-hmm. Also during that period, slaves that became collaterals for loans because land was plentiful and no one would lend you money on the basis of land property. So that a lot of people in the slave states used slaves as collaterals for their loans. So that, you know, these that enslaved Americans, without them, the U.S. that would not have but even started mm-hmm. off. But, you know, without that, paradoxically, the slave revolt in Haiti, the U.S. Could not have become the continental-sized country that it later became. And I think that a small, well, relatively large but not huge country stuck on the eastern seaboard with 15, 16 states that would not have become the global superpower that it is today.
Now, I enjoyed your book enormously, and every chapter starts with a food commodity. In one case, it's Coca-Cola. And I learned that General Zhukov, the famous Soviet general, they used to send him Coca-Cola that had the color removed so that he would not be seen to be drinking an imperialist beverage when he went back to Moscow.
He was an absolute genius of strategies.
It's a fabulous book, really, really entertaining and informative. I learned a lot about Switzerland, which per capita is a huge industrial power, a manufacturing power, as it turned out. Anyway, the book is called Edible Economics: A Hungry Economist Explains the World. It's available in hardback in all good bookshops now. And its author, Ha Jun Chang, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Travel on the Pat Kenny Show.
Thanks to Ryanair. Flying you to over 200 destinations is our business. What you do there is yours.
It may be too soon to talk about Christmas, but it's not too early to talk about Christmas travel. And Irish Independent travel editor Paul O'Connella joins us with an insight into the Christmas markets, the hotel breaks, and all the travel news ahead of the festive season. Paul, good morning.
Hiya, Pat. How are you doing?
I'm doing grand. Now, first of all, the actual travel business itself, airports more or less sorted?
Well, I wouldn't like to be sort of tied to that, but they have certainly improved since the summer of chaos that we've seen. And the bank holiday, I suppose, was the most recent peak period. Dublin Airport saw about 350,000 passengers go through. Now, there were queues and so on, but nothing like what we saw last May. Another thing to note, it's parking completely sold out. So if you are going to be booking parking in busy times to come, definitely do that in advance or get a lift. But looming like a sort of an iceberg on the horizon really is the Christmas travel period, because outside of the peak months of June and July, that is really when the numbers swell. And we have already seen London Heathrow, for example, warning that it may have to reintroduce a cap on passenger numbers. People are kind of looking at it with trepidation, because though they have ironed out a lot of the problems, there's still the underlying issues of staffing and so on do still exist out there in the industry.
Yeah. Okay. Now, if you don't want to use an airport, hotel breaks in Ireland, I mean, I presume they also rise in price at this time of the year.
They do for Christmas, absolutely. But what you are getting a lot of value thrown in there as well. And this is something that the whole concept of a residential Christmas break, or basically checking into a hotel on Christmas Eve and staying for a couple of days, has really grown in recent years in Ireland. And the packages are very polished now. When you check in, you will pay top dollar, but what you're going to sort of get, not just the mulled wine and the mince pies on arrival, but the full entertainment program, the place will be decked up to the nines, Santa will visit for the kids, and typically the lunches and Christmas dinners and evening buffets will be included, and some of them will even include drinks and activities along. So really, they're investing a lot in getting the staff to stay and to work at that time. They've calculated the prices very carefully, and there is demand, Pat. We were putting together a spread on this not long ago for the Irish Independent Weekend magazine, and already places like Adair Manor, Ballinahinch, Ashford Castle sold out for Christmas. But there is availability still.
at a price.
at a price. That's why I'm hesitating. I have a couple. I'll give you a couple of quick examples. Let's say, taking at the bottom end, for €367 per person, there's a two-night break in Brooks Hotel in Dublin, which is just a stone's throw from Grafton Street, and that includes a five-course Christmas lunch, the breakfasts, the mince pies, and that. And you'll be right in position in the city there for the Christmas sale. So that's kind of the entry level for two nights. Then mid-level, Glass and Lake House. I plugged that one out on Loch Ree. It's a press-up hotel, four-star. It has a golf course, new spa, outdoor hot tubs, lots of roaring fires and cocktails and all the rest. And the meals are included, €869 per person. And then going five-star, Ireland's newest five-star, in fact, Cashel Palace Hotel in County Tipperary has a three-night package. It's important to look at how many nights are included in these, obviously, as well. But with the Christmas lunch, with the Tipperary Fork Supper, they're calling it on the big day, and so on, with guided walks thrown in, €1,495 per person. So perhaps that would be your Christmas gift to each other as well as the stay.
Okay, so if we are then more intrepid and we want to go Christmas market hunting in Europe, where would you recommend?
I love the idea of this being back on the cards, because we've had two, 3 years now where we weren't able, and we were kind of watching enviously as those lovely atmospheric town squares with their chalets kicked off across Europe. And we started off by talking about how expensive travel over Christmas can be, but these markets kick off at the end of November, often running through to Christmas Eve or even into early January. And if you can travel during the school term, and particularly midweek, I've been pricing, you know, trips to places like Poland or Germany, particularly lesser known cities, and for a night or two they start from as little as 130 per person for the flights and the hotel. So it just goes to show you that if you can be flexible, you can get the bargains. Have a look at travel agents for these, unless of course you want to book your own hotel and flights or an Airbnb, but the Irish agents like Click and Go, Travel Department, Abbey Travel, Cassidy and so on will all package up these offers quite neatly. I love Krakow. I don't know if you've been to Krakow in winter.
No, not yet.
It's complete. The main square is just like a fairy tale, with the tower in the middle of it and the clip-clop of the horse's hooves around you, and the smell of the glühwein from the stalls and the roasting chestnuts. And they put a big emphasis on the handmade toys. Now, I've never actually filled my suitcases with these things. My kids probably throw them back at me, but I just love being surrounded by that kind of culture. And you know, the same guys have been in the same stall for generations making these things.
Budapest I have been to, but not at Christmas time.
Oh, it's lovely again at Christmas. And if you get lucky with the snow, we can't bank on that. It just adds this extra Disney-esque kind of element to it. I mean, Budapest, again, this in Hungary has been doing this for yonks, centuries. It's got it right down to a T. It's not parachuting chalets into the fair green for a couple of nights, you know. The Basilica Market is the main one there. There's a lovely house called the Gerbo House. It's an 18th century building where they make the building itself into an advent calendar over Christmas, and each day at 5 o'clock they open a window on the building to reveal a new painting. It just kind of gives you a sense of the scale and the thought that goes into it.
Now, Prague is another fairy tale city. I presume they do it up even more for Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. It looks like a chandelier. The cathedral and the old square in the evening when the lights go on anyway. But yeah, the Charles Bridge, the old town, and the enormous Christmas trees they have decked up there. There's several markets throughout Prague, as you'll find in a lot of these great European cities. It's not just one. So you can kind of tip along between one and the other. And what I'd be recommending you have a bite of there is the Trdelník pastries. They're sort of sweet pastries that are wrapped around a skewer, and they're sprinkled with cinnamon sugar. So you take it away on the skewer and kind of munch it as you're going from stall to stall.
And finally, if you want to stay in this benighted island of ours, there is a Dublin Christmas market and Christmas markets around the country.
Yeah, and we'll no doubt revisit this, because the colour they bring to cities are like Galway, Waterford's going to have its Winterfell Festival, Belfast Market will be kicking off around City Hall. But I highlighted Dublin for you at this stage. It will run from the December 7th to the 20th, but Christmas at the Castle is back as part of the whole, as Fulch Ireland's whole Winter in Dublin seasonal play. And that It's a lovely idea, and I don't know why we hadn't been doing this for generations, but it brings the traditional Alpine market stall setup into the courtyard of Dublin Castle. So that'll be a great excuse to get back into the city.
All right. Well, it sounds very attractive. You know, these Alpine markets with their snow, which is normal in Central Europe, I suppose with us, we'd get the fire department out hosing us down to create winter rain. Anyway.
And it'll be a happy Christmas at that.
Paul O'Connell, travel editor with the Irish Independent. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.
McCrispy strips are now at McDonald's. Tender, juicy, and its own sauce. Would you look at that? Well, you can't see it, but trust me, it looks delicious. New McCrispy strips, now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.